Now, as I was saying, we've talked about a number of these topics before, and we'll see a few more before we're done, in that we think illustrate certain aspects of our New Testament doctrines. And the last one or two we've looked at was managing fear in verses 1 through 15 of chapter 18. And then we looked at confronting evil also challenging ourselves for decisiveness, and glorifying God was another topic. And in the last week, we started looking at the concept of prayer being illustrated by Elijah's life and some of the principles there. And there's about three major principles, four major principles of our New Testament teaching on prayer that we see illustrated in Elijah's life. The first point we made was that we have both a privilege and a duty to pray. And we see that in verses 36 and 37 of chapter 18. Verses like Philippians 4:6, which says, "Do not be anxious about anything, but in every situation, by prayer and petition, with thanksgiving, present your requests to God." Every situation is one in which it is appropriate for us to pray about. And James mentioned a classic passage in James chapter 5 and verse 16, that the fervent prayer of a righteous man can avail much, can accomplish a lot. And so that's a good reminder that we see Elijah illustrate. Then we saw the second principle in verses 30 through 37 of chapter 18, and that is that of intercession. Part of our prayer life should be intercessory. We represent and pray for others of God's family, and some passages that kind of stress that for us would include Ephesians 6:18. "And pray in the Spirit on all occasions with all kinds of prayer and requests. With this in mind, be alert and always keep on praying for all the Lord's people." So when Isaiah represented the entirety of the nation Israel, both the north and south kingdoms, even though he is just kind of ministering to the north, he was doing that. He was illustrating that. He was praying for all of the Lord's people. And then also, Paul tells us in 1 Timothy 2:1, "I urge then, first of all, that petitions, prayers, and intercessions and thanksgiving be made for all people." So the concept of interceding is another one of our New Testament principles that Elijah illustrates. And we want to pick up the trail this morning. We'll see another one. Let's start at about, we saw the fire being sent down from God to consume the altar, didn't we? He soaked that sucker down, and there was a trench of water around it. I mean, it's poured water all over it, and God still zapped that sucker and set it on fire in answer to Elijah's prayer in verses 38 and 39. And the people responded in verse 39 and said, "The Lord, He is God. The Lord, He is God." So then in verse 40, Elijah said to them, remember, he's got this collection of people, who knows how many hundreds and thousands, that are gathered together here on Mount Carmel. This is where this incident is taking place. So he tells the people that are there, and I don't know how many it is, but I'm going to guess it's probably numbering at least a few thousand. He says, "Go and grab all of those prophets of Baal," verse 40. "Do not let one of them escape." So they seized them, and Elijah brought them down to the brook Kishon, and he slew them there. Wow. So he goes and captures all 450 of these prophets of Baal that are there, with whom he was kind of competing in this whole incident. And he kills them all. Wipes those suckers out. So now all of a sudden, there's not as quite as much Baal worship going on in the nation as there was there? 450 of their priests have just been slain by the people in accordance with Deuteronomy chapter 13, which tells them, don't tolerate a false priest. Put them to death, God told his people. So he's just doing what has been told to him to do in Deuteronomy chapter 13. So he slays them there. Now, verse 41, Elijah said to Ahab, "Go eat and drink, for there is the sound of a roar of a heavy shower." Remember, it hadn't rained now for 3.5 years. And Elijah tells Ahab, the king, to go and get ready to leave the area because he says, Elijah says, a heavy shower is going to come. So Ahab went up to eat and drink, but Elijah went up to the top of Carmel, and he crouched down on the earth and put his face between his knees. And he said to his servant, go now and look toward the sea. So he went and he looked and he said, there's nothing there. And Elijah sent him back seven times. So this servant goes and looks out over the sea, the Mediterranean here, and to see if there's some rain coming up. And he says, I don't see a thing. So Elijah says, he prays some more, and he says, go back and look again. He goes and looks again. He says, I still don't see anything, Elijah. Seven times he does this. And it came about at the seventh time that he said, well, behold, a cloud as small as a man's hand is coming up from the sea. Guy's got pretty good eyesight, doesn't he? Spot a cloud the size of a man's hand, just a little bitty thing. And he said, well, go up, say to Ahab, prepare your chariot and go down so that the heavy shower does not stop you. So it came about in a little while that the sky grew black with clouds and wind, and there was a heavy shower, and Ahab rode and went to Jezreel. And the hand of the Lord was on Elijah, and he girded up his loins and outran Ahab to Jezreel. Now here's Jezreel down here, right here, and they're up here. That's about a 15 to 20 mile jaunt right there. Not quite a marathon, not quite 26 miles, but it ain't a whole lot less. So Elijah warns Ahab and he says, better get out of here because it's going to rain and rain hard. And he leaves, Ahab leaves in his chariot. And Elijah tucks his robe in his belt and runs to Jezreel and beats him there. Could you run a 20-mile jaunt like that? I couldn't drive 20 miles without getting tired. So he girds up his loins and outruns him back down to here. This is where Ahab had sort of a summer palace, second home, so to speak. And so that's why he goes there. So what in the world are we seeing in this particular incident? Well, we're seeing another one of our New Testament principles concerning prayer, and that is persistence. Seven times, this guy has to go back and look and come back and tell Elijah, nah, man, ain't nothing happening. There ain't no rain coming. And he keeps on praying and keeps on praying. And the Lord told us some things about that. The principle of persistence is one of those that needs to be part of our prayer life. In Luke chapter 11, verses 5 through 13, remember that story about the guy that his neighbor wakes him up in the middle of the night and says, I need some stuff. I have some visitors dropped in on me, and I need some help. I need some stuff. And the neighbor says, get out of here. It's the middle of the night. I'm not going to fool with you. And he just keeps bugging him and keeps bugging him until the neighbor gives him what he wanted. So the Lord tells us in that experience in Luke 11, verse 8, I'll tell you, even though he will not get up and give you the bread because of friendship, yet because of your shameless audacity, he will surely get up and give you as much as you need. It's the persistence that paid off there. Not the friendship, but persistence. So when you pray, persist. Elijah persisted seven times praying for rain, and it finally came. And in Luke chapter 18, verses 1 through 8, we have another New Testament principle illustrated here. Jesus told his disciples a parable to show them that they should always pray and not give up. And he went on with the story there, but when we'll go through the story, but the principle there is persistence in prayer is another one of our New Testament principles that is illustrated here by Elijah's life. And the fourth one, first, there are the privilege and the duty to prayer, intercession, persistence, and the fourth one is praying according to God's will. Remember, that's always a necessary requisite. Proof of that fact that I'm not driving around in a new Corvette. We have to pray according to God's will. That ain't and so I ain't. In Matthew 6, when the Lord was giving us a pattern for how to pray, the Lord's Prayer, as we call it, one of the parts of that was, Thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. One of the parts of our pattern of prayer, our model, is to always pray according to God's will. You can ask willy-nilly stuff if you want to, but you're not going to get it. It's got to be according to God's will. And in 1 John 5:14, a New Testament principle illustrated here, this is the confidence we have before Him, that if we ask anything according to His will, He hears us. How do we know it was God's will that it would rain? Because He said it was. He told Elijah that. Remember back in verse 1 of chapter 18? He says, hey, Elijah, go show yourself to Ahab, and I will send rain on the face of the earth. So he knew it was God's will that it was going to rain. God had told him that. And by the way, you always need that statement from God, not something you want to happen. Hoping something happens ain't a game plan. But praying according to God's will is, and so Elijah knew that. So those four principles now we see illustrated in Elijah's life that we are taught in the New Testament. The privilege and duty to pray, intercessory component, a persistence component, and praying according to God's will. So all of that we see illustrated here by Elijah in this particular incident. Any questions about that before we move on here a little bit? Okay. Let me get my junk out of the way here so I can see what's next. So, as it turns out then, Elijah prays, God answers his prayer, sends the rain. Ahab heads down to his summer palace there at Jezreel, and Elijah sort of supernaturally is empowered to run that distance and actually get there before his horses do. You usually can't outrun horses over a long distance. 20 miles, a horse is going to win about 100% of the time. But in this case, God enabled him and he outran him and got down there. Now, how would you at this point in time, let's pause for just a minute before we're going into chapter 19, how would you kind of describe or characterize Elijah from what we've seen so far? Pretty impressive guy, isn't he? Pretty strong guy. Faithful, bold, dedicated to serving God, stands in the face of this wicked king Ahab and pronounces a judgment on his empire that flies in the face of his wonderful God Baal and all that other stuff. Elijah is a very impressive, courageous servant so far in his life from everything we've seen in him. Well, let's go on. Unfortunately, we have to go on, unfortunately for Elijah. And look at chapter 19. Chapter 19, now Ahab told Jezebel, that's his wife, of course, all that Elijah had done and how he killed all the prophets with the sword. These were her pet projects. 450 of these priests served Baal. Another 400 served his female associate. It's either his mother or it's his associate. The Asheroth, it's called. Depends on one's interpretation there. We're not told what happened to them, but the 450 priests of Baal, Elijah killed. Talk about messing up her sandbox. So then Jezebel sends a message to Elijah saying, so may the gods do to me, and even more, if I do not make your life as the life of one of them by tomorrow about this time. In other words, she says, Elijah, I'm going to do the same thing to you you just did to my prophets. I'm going to kill you. You're a dead man by this time tomorrow, Elijah. And how did our bold, brave, heroic individual respond?
He ran.
Verse 3. His knees start banging together. He was afraid, and he arose and he ran for his life. What happened to our guy? Where did our bold, brave servant of God go? All of a sudden now, we got a guy who is fearing for his life and running from one woman. He stands before 450 priests of Baal, before the wicked king Ahab, and when his wife threatens him, he runs. How can these things be? Well, they be. And he went all the way down to Beersheba, which belongs to Judah. That's kind of the southern end of the kingdom down here. He runs all the way down to here, from up at Jezreel. What do we got there? Maybe 100 miles, 150 miles, something like that. A long way. I mean, he hooks them big time and gets all the way down to there. And not only does he go a long way away, he went a day's journey into the wilderness and came and sat down under a juniper tree. That's a day's journey from Beersheba, I take it. Sat underneath some tree and requested for himself that he might die. He is giving up. He's throwing in the towel. He is despondent. He is depressed. He wants to die. So he asks God to take his life. And he says, "It is enough now, O Lord, take my life, for I'm not better than my fathers. I'm trying to rid Baal worship from the nation, and I haven't done any better job than my fathers have done." And I got this unhappy squeeze trying to run me down and kill me. What has happened to him that he all of a sudden now is displaying this depression and despondency when just a little bit before he's on top of the mountain? What explains this change in behavior? Well, there are different recipes for depression, aren't they? Some of them involve body chemistry, hormonal imbalances and stuff that I don't know anything about, other than I do know that postpartum depression can turn a perfectly normal person into a basket case. I've seen that up close and personal. So some of these things, some changes in behavior and thinking and actions, can be the result of body chemistry problems, issues of some kind like that. And I don't know about those, and so we're not going to talk about them very much. I can't help you with anything like that. Some forms of depression are the result of chronic pain, chronic misery. You just are so depressed and downhearted over constant, ongoing, relentless pain that your focus is solely on oneself. You can't focus on anything else. You can't function normally because you're just miserable. And I can't help you with that one either. Don't know what to do about that. Some of it is the result, however, of fear of circumstances. Sometimes the triggering mechanism for depression and despondency is fear of circumstances. I can help you with that one a little bit, because the scriptures talk to that one, and we'll talk about that a little bit. That's the one that I think Elijah is experiencing here. First of all, let's remind ourselves that this kind of change in behavior, this abrupt, drastic change in behavior, can happen to any of us. Why is that so? Why is that a possibility that we can change so drastically there? Because you have a nature inside of you that you can't get rid of, that is trying, at times with the help of our great adversary, to make you a miserable person. It's wanting to hurt you. It's wanting to harm you. It's wanting you to behave in a way that is contrary to godliness. Where'd you get that nature? Well, your good old great, 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 whatever ancestor gave it to you, and everybody down the line from him. We inherit that from Adam, don't we? You get it from your dad. How do you know you don't get it from your mother? I've told you this before now. Pay close attention. You know the answer. How do you know that that sin nature is transmitted through your father? Did the Lord have an earthly father? No. Did he have a sin nature? No. He couldn't have an earthly father or he would have had a sin nature. That's where it comes from. It doesn't come through the mother. It comes through the father. That's why he could not have an earthly father. It's okay to have an earthly mother and not have a sin nature because you don't get it from your mother. So good job, ladies. Keep up the good work. Now, we inherit that through our fathers, it appears. There's some debate and argument about that, but that looks like that's the case because that's why the Lord couldn't have one. And it is of this nature. In Galatians 5:17, Paul says, "For the flesh desires what is contrary to the Spirit." The flesh is that sin nature we're talking about. "And the Spirit, what is contrary to the flesh. They are in conflict with each other so that you do not do what you want." So you have a mechanism within your being that will prompt you, help you, exacerbate for you doing what you don't want to do. That's your sin nature. And that classic section there in Romans chapter 7, Paul talks about it at a little more length. Let me read this for you real quick. "I do not understand," this is Romans 7, 15 through 25. "I do not understand what I do. For what I want to do, I do not do. But what I hate, I do. And if I do what I do not want to do, I agree with the law is good. It is no longer I myself who do it, but it is sin living in me," the sin nature. "For I know that good itself does not dwell in me, that is my sinful nature. For I have the desire to do what is good, but I cannot carry it out. For I do not do the good I want to do, but the evil I do not want to do, this I keep on doing. Now, if I do not do what I want to do, it is no longer I who do it, but it is sin living in me that does it." And you can see this tension, this frustration building in Paul's comments here about this interior nature that makes him do something he doesn't want to do. So I find this law at work. "Although I want to do good, evil is right there with me. For in my inner being I delight in God's law, but I see another law at work in me, waging war against the law of my mind and making me a prisoner of the law of sin at work in me. What a wretched man I am." And that's the conclusion that you will come to if you really understand this conflict. It leaves you in a wretched state. So how do you get out of that? Who solves that for me? Paul says, "Who will rescue me from this body that is subject to death?" And he answers his own question, "Thanks be to God who delivers me through Jesus Christ our Lord. So then I myself, in my mind, am a slave to God's law, but in my sinful nature, a slave to the law of sin." So the conflict is a dominating, frustrating conflict that can produce in us behavior that we don't want to do, a sin nature. And if you don't think you have one, he says, 1 John 1:8-10 says, "If we claim to be without sin, we deceive ourselves and the truth is not in us." And he goes on there with some more truth. But the point of these passages is that what Elijah is illustrating with this abrupt, thorough change in perspective and behavior is the result, or can be the result, of that sin nature that indwells us. We can all do the same thing. We can go from behaving Christ-like in a godly manner to being sinful and difficult and all of that. So first point that he's illustrating is that sin nature is at work in us and can cause depression and despondency in our lives. You think Satan is at work at all when that kind of stuff goes on? I'd certainly look for him. I think his fingerprints would be on a lot of cases of depression and difficulty. That is fear-induced depression. Not talking about these medical causes now. I don't know anything about that. But this fear-induced despondency, I think he can definitely be at work there. And we'll have to watch for that. Now, also we know that this kind of thing is not rare. It's very commonplace to man's experience. Few passages that indicate that, and also where our source of help is. Psalm 34:18, "The Lord is close to the brokenhearted and saves those who are crushed in spirit. If you're never going to be crushed in spirit, if that's not a common malady for believers, why would you have these encouraging verses on how to deal with it? Proverbs 17:22, a cheerful heart is good medicine, but a crushed spirit dries up the bones. 2 Corinthians chapter 7, Paul talks about himself. He says, for when we came to Macedonia, we had no rest. We were harassed at every turn, conflicts on the outside, fears within. But God, who comforts the downcast, comforted us by the coming of Titus and some other things. And a classic passage there, 1 Corinthians 10:13. No temptation or test. Now, this is not a solicitation to evil, not that kind of temptation, but a test. No test has overtaken you except what is common to mankind. These things are not rare. Depression and discouragement are commonplace in our experience, and God is faithful and won't let us go be tested beyond what we're able to bear. So our sin natures can certainly make it a realistic thing that we have to deal with. It is fairly commonplace in the experience of man. And as I said before, fear is oftentimes a triggering mechanism for this type of depression, not the medical kind, but for this kind of depression. Some classic examples of that include remember that first group that came out of Egypt, God sent them up to Kadesh Barnea, and he said, now go spy out the land. And they did, and they came back and said, oh my gosh, we seemed like, this is Numbers 13, 30 through chapter 14, verse 4. He says, we seemed like grasshoppers in our own eyes, and we looked the same to them. We're scared of those big, burly guys in the promised land, they said. And so they make a decision in verse 4 of chapter 14. They said to each other, well, we should choose a leader and go back to Egypt. Is that good thinking? Let's choose up a leader and go back and live under that Egyptian bondage and be treated like dirt for another several hundred years. That's a good idea. That's good thinking that comes out of this sort of condition. David illustrated the same thing. In 1 Samuel 27, first 10 verses, he says, among other things, one of these days I will be destroyed by the hand of Saul. The best thing I can do is to escape to the land of the Philistines. He says, I'm going to go live among God's enemies. That's a good idea. I'm so scared of Saul, I'm going to go live among God's enemies. And so he wrote a psalm about that time, expressing his fear and anxiety. This is Psalm 55, verse 2. My thoughts trouble me, and I'm distraught because of what my enemy is saying, because of the threats of the wicked. That sounds just like Elijah, doesn't it? Being threatened by Jezebel. Verse 4, Psalm 55. My heart is in anguish within me. The terrors of death have fallen on me. Fear and trembling have beset me. Horror has overwhelmed me. Verse 7. Now, verse 6, he says, oh, if I had the wings of a dove, I would fly away and be at rest. I would flee far away and stay in the desert. What did Elijah just do? Fled far away and stayed in the desert. Same basic symptoms, same basic feelings and problems that David experienced in his life as well. Fear-induced despondency. And maybe the best example of all is Peter. Peter denied the Lord three times, right? He was fearful. These lowest rung on the social ladder, some servant girl working the door, says she knew him. And what's he do? He denies the Lord three times. And he went out and wept bitterly. So fear drove him into a similar state that we see Elijah illustrating here as well. And in that state, unfortunately, we can make some really boneheaded decisions that are the result of hardening our hearts. Some more New Testament passages that illustrated here. Hebrews 3, 7 through 12. So the Holy Spirit says, today if you hear His voice, do not harden your hearts as you did in the rebellion. He's talking to believers. The author to Hebrews is talking to believers. And he said, don't harden your heart like those guys did. In verse 12 of that same passage, Hebrews 3, 7 through 12, it says, "See to it, brothers and sisters, that none of you has a sinful, unbelieving heart that turns away from the living God." So if we're not careful, depression can lead us to making these kind of decisions, hardening our hearts, making bad decisions that lead us away from God, not back to Him. And in Mark 6, 52, the Lord's talking to His disciples, and He said, "For they had not understood about the loaves, their hearts were hardened." Believers can harden their hearts. Mark 8, 17 and 18 says, "Are your hearts hardened? Do you have eyes but fail to see, and ears that fail to hear, and don't you remember?" And of course, another classic example, Revelation chapter 3, the church at Laodicea, that indifferent church, the one who was neither hot nor cold, and the Lord was going to spit them out of His mouth. Depression can lead us to making bad, heart-hardened decisions that leads us to disobedience and problems. So what is the attitude we should have in fearing all of these things, or in dealing with these things? How do we seek to avoid depression? Well, we have several passages again in the New Testament that help us there. 1 Peter 3:14, "But even if you should suffer for what is right, you are blessed. Do not fear their threats. Do not be frightened." We're never told in Scripture to fear anything but God. Never man, never the angelic realm, never anything but God Himself. Do not fear. In Matthew chapter 6, the Lord tells us in verse 25 and 27, "Therefore I tell you, do not worry about your life." Fear and worry are not to characterize us believers. And in Matthew 10, 26 and 28, He says, "Do not be afraid of them. Do not be afraid of those who kill the body but cannot kill the soul." So we're repeatedly told, do not fear them. Paul talked about the right attitude in 2 Corinthians chapter 4, verses 8 through 18. He says, "We're hard-pressed on every side, but not crushed. Perplexed, but not in despair. Persecuted, but not abandoned. Struck down, but not destroyed." He says, we know we're going to take a pounding from time to time. Elijah's taking a pounding. But don't despair, is what Paul says. Don't let these fear of circumstances beat you down to the point of despair, which Elijah did. In that same passage, 2 Corinthians 4, he says, verse 13, "Since we have that same spirit of faith," and jump down to verse 16, "therefore we do not lose heart." It is faith that keeps us from losing heart and becoming despondent and depressed like Elijah did. And then kind of the wrapping up the attitudes in Philippians chapter 3, verses 12 through 17, Paul says, "Not that I've already obtained this or already arrived at my goal, but I press on and take hold of that for which Christ Jesus took hold of me. Brothers and sisters, I do not consider myself yet as having taken hold of it, but one thing I do, forgetting what is behind," that would be the circumstances of life, "and straining toward what is ahead, I press on toward the goal to win the prize for which God has called me heavenward in Christ Jesus." Stay in the game, Paul says. Even though these are difficulties, don't give up. Don't throw in the towel. 1 Corinthians 15:58. "Therefore, my dear brothers and sisters, stand firm. Let nothing move you. Always give yourselves fully to the work of the Lord." And in Galatians 6:9, "Let us not become weary in doing good, for in the proper time we will reap a harvest if we do not give up." Now, what Elijah is illustrating, of course, in all of this, is that he's not doing these things. He's not hanging up. He's not hanging in. He's not persisting. He's not staying in the game. He's bailing on God. He says, "God, I'm a failure here. Go ahead and take my life. I haven't accomplished any more than my fathers did, so just go on and get rid of me. I'm out of it. Take my towel, and I'm throwing it in." And he's quitting. this from a guy who we just saw in the previous chapters was a hero of the faith. And yet, he let his fear of circumstances knock him down to this level of discouragement and depression. And all of our New Testament exhortations is, don't do that. Don't let these things beat you down like that. But he's beat down pretty good. Let's go on and read a little bit more here and see what else we can glean. He lay down and slept under a juniper tree, and behold, there was an angel touching him and said to him, arise, eat. And he looked, and behold, there was at his head a bread cake baked on hot stones and a jar of water. So he ate and drank and lay down again. Then the angel of the Lord came a second time, touched him and said, arise, eat, because the journey is too great for you. So he rose, ate and drank, and went in the strength of that food 40 days and 40 nights to Horeb, the mountain of God. That's down, I don't know if I brought a map, south central Sinai. That's down where Moses got the law, down there in the south central part of the Sinai Peninsula. You remember that on the map. He went on down there, way on down there. So he's come from all the way up to the northern part at Mount Carmel, all the way down like 300 miles south to Mount Horeb or to Mount Sinai there in the Sinai Peninsula. And he came there to a cave and lodged there. So he came down to around Mount Sinai where Moses got the law, and he hung up in a cave for a little while. So how does God handle his guy here? What does God do to pick this guy up? He clearly ain't picking himself up. He's just digging his hole deeper and deeper. He's running further and further away from his point of service where God had sent him to minister and that sort of thing. And he's hanging out in this cave. And so God appeals to him appears to him in verse 9, and he says to him, Elijah, what are you doing here? He says, if I remember right, Elijah, I sent you to minister to Ahab up there around Samaria and Jezreel and up there where Ahab's kingdom was. What the heck are you doing down here? What's Elijah's answer? He says, hey, I've been zealous for you all along. But the sons of Israel have forsaken thy covenant, torn down thine altars, and killed the prophets with the sword, and I alone am left, and they seek my life to take it away. So his answer to God is, what am I doing down here? Is, well, there's a pity party down here, and I'm the only one invited. I'm down here rolling in self-pity. I'm not doing anything, is his answer. It's interesting to note here, however, that the first thing God did was try to get him physically refreshed, didn't he? He's sleeping, he's eating, he's drinking, he's taking care of his physical needs, first thing. Sometimes it's hard to reach somebody if they're just physically shot with any kind of a message, isn't it? They're just kind of hanging on. I remember I used to go down to Union Gospel Mission with some guys from the church here and speak to those guys down there. Man, you talk about a hard nut to crack. You think those guys wanted to hear about dispensationalism? They wanted to hear about, when do I get to that bowl of soup back here in the back? That's all they want to know. They're physically hungry, wore out, beat down. I mean, just look at them and see that these guys have been ran over in life by all kinds of circumstances. And I'm racking my brain trying to think of something to tell them that they would be interested in. And all they want is that bowl of soup. They don't care about my theology. They're just hungry. But the order of business was, we preach first, they eat second. Otherwise, they wouldn't sit there for nothing. If you gave them the food, they'd leave. So they made them sit there until and hear the message whether they wanted to or not. But I could tell from just looking at their faces, man, I am pushing a chain up a hill here. This is hard. They're not going to respond. And so I think maybe the first order of business when people are depressed or discouraged or despondent is, first of all, refresh yourself physically. Get some sleep, eat something, rest, get some R&R, get your physical body right, and then maybe you're in a position where you can actually listen to or contend with or deal with other aspects of the problem. So he does that first. The Lord even did that. You remember he took the disciples aside at times and said, man, come over here and let's get some rest. In Mark chapter 6, verse 31, he says, then because so many people were coming and going and did not even have a chance to eat, he said to them, come with me by yourselves to a quiet place and get some rest. So they went away by themselves in a boat to a solitary place. Now, if the Lord needed a little R&R, what do you think we need? So he starts out by trying to help Elijah with that, with some R&R. Then when he asks him what the heck he's doing here, trying to get him to focus on his ministry, what he should be doing, he gets the answer back, well, I'm down here pitying myself in verse 10. So the Lord says to him in verse 11, go forth and stand on the mountain before the Lord. This would be Sinai, I guess. And the Lord was passing by. And a great strong wind was rending the mountains and breaking in pieces the rocks before the Lord. But the Lord was not in the wind. So he has Elijah stand sort of in a similar place that Moses did, and he shakes the earth with some sort of manifestation that you might think is God's presence, but no, that wasn't him. He wasn't actually going to reveal himself in that. Afterward, the wind and the earthquake. Well, first there was wind, then there was the earthquake, and after that, the wind. After the wind, an earthquake, but the Lord was not in the earthquake either. And after the earthquake, there was fire, but the Lord was not in the fire. So he sends these three miraculous indications of what could be his presence, as though he was going to communicate to Elijah in that particular way, wind, earthquake, and a fire. But he didn't say squat to Elijah from those. That was not going to be the means by which he spoke to Elijah. Verse 12, after the fire, a sound of gentle blowing. And it came about when Elijah heard it that he wrapped his face in his mantle. In other words, he recognizes that was the Lord's voice. So he wraps his face in his mantle and he went out and stood at the entrance of the cave. And behold, a voice came to him and said, what are you doing here, Elijah? This gentle, quiet voice asks him again the same thing that God asked him before. What are you doing here, Elijah, at Mount Sinai, when you should be up there in Ahab's face where I sent you? What are you doing down here? And Elijah gives him the same pitiful answer. He says, I've been very zealous for the Lord, the God of hosts, for the sons of Israel have forsaken that covenant, torn down thine altars, and killed the prophets with the sword. And I alone am left, and they seek my life to take it. He gives him the same limp leg answer, taking pity upon himself, and he responds in the same way. So what's the Lord actually then tell him to do? Verse 15, he says, go, return on your way to the wilderness of Damascus, and when you have arrived, you shall anoint Hazael king over Aram, that's Syria, and Jehu the son of Nishi you shall anoint king over Israel, and Elisha the son of Shaphat, the Abel-Meholah or something like that, you shall anoint the prophet in your place. And it come about that whoever escapes from the sword of Hazael, Jehu shall put to death, and the one who escapes from the sword of Jehu, Elisha shall put to death. That is, the guys you're going to appoint are going to finish the work that you started. They're going to wipe out this Baal worship, and whoever gets away from this first guy, the second guy will get, and whoever gets away from the second guy, Elisha will get. Yet I will leave 7,000 in Israel, all the knees that have not bowed to Baal, and every mouth that has not kissed him. So God basically says, Elijah, get up and get back to work. I got three things I want you to do. Anoint the king over Syria, anoint the king over Israel, and appoint your own successor. So what has he done here? Did he give Elijah a booster shot in faith? He didn't say a thing about his faith. He said, Elijah, get back to work. And leave this pity party behind and go back where you're supposed to be and get back to work. Now, when we studied the book of James, I pointed out to you that the relationship between works and faith in the book of James, in my opinion, is not what you normally hear. It is normally taught by 95% of all the commentators that you're going to read and the pastors and preachers and everybody else. They're going to tell you that it is faith that drives works. Now, I'm going to tell you that ain't what he says. I'm going to tell you that it's works that drives faith. Look at what he actually says in James chapter 2, particularly verse 2:26. James concludes his arguments in this chapter about the relationship between works and faith with this analogy. Verse 26, as the body without the spirit is dead, so faith without deeds is dead. What he actually says, and this is not what you typically hear, but he says that the relationship between the spirit to the body is analogous to works is to faith. What is the relationship between the spirit to the body? The spirit energizes your body. If you don't think that's true, stand beside the coffin of a deceased person and see how much energy you see going on there when that spirit is gone. There is no more energy there. When the spirit departed that body, nothing happens after that. There is no energy. There's no life to the body. It's gone. That's the relationship of the spirit to the body. And James says that that relationship is the same as what deeds are to faith. That is, deeds, faith, excuse me, works and deeds energize our faith. That's what he says. And that's not the way we normally teach it. But that's what he says. And that's what is illustrated in Elijah's life. When God gets him up and going again, he doesn't give him that faith booster shot. He doesn't say, well, your problem, Elijah, is that your faith is so weak that you've stopped working. He says, you need to get back to work in order to energize and give a dynamic to your faith. You see that in verse 26? Can you read that any differently than what I'm saying there? The analogy is, as the body without the spirit is dead, that is, what the spirit does for the body is the same thing as what deeds do for our faith. So that the absence of the spirit or the absence of works ends up with something dead, either the body or our faith. That's what he says. So, I think what God illustrates here in his handling of Elijah is that truth. He puts him back to work. He says, I got three jobs for you, guy. Get out of here. Get back up where you belong, and I want you to anoint the king of Syria. I want you to anoint the king of Israel, and I want you to anoint Elijah as your replacement. Go to work, Elijah. And that will bolster, it will give a dynamic, it will promote your faith and get you back going again. You see that? You won't hear that taught that way very much. Everybody, I guess the publishers don't want to hear that. They want things to be non-controversial, straightforward, just like they've been forever, I guess. And nearly all of your books will say, well, no, no. It's your faith that drives your works. without good faith, you won't do any works. Well, how do you bolster your faith? You're given faith by God, for by grace are you saved through faith, and that not of yourselves. It is the gift of God. You're given faith by God. You don't get to just go out there and stop at the faith fill-up pump and jack it up every now and then. You either have it or you don't have it. But what bolsters it, what promotes its health and dynamic, is service, deeds, works. That's what James says. And that's what Elijah's life illustrates. God puts him back to work, and he does. All right, we're going to have to back off here this morning. Questions or comments about anything we've seen so far? We're looking at how God helps Elijah deal with his depression and despondency. We know from our New Testament examples that it certainly shouldn't characterize a believer's life. And the way God does that is that he gives him work to do, service to do, and tells him to get after it. Now, we're talking about a despondency, a depression that is fear-induced, not the other kind. There's other kinds. We don't know about those. So we're just talking about the kind that it looks like is illustrated by Elijah's life. Service. Stop focusing on self. Stop celebrating that pity party and get back to serving God. Stay in the game and get back at it. That's what I think he's doing here and what we're seeing. Questions or comments about any of that? I told you when we went through James that the normal interpretation of that is not right. It isn't what he says. I don't know how we've gotten off onto that so far that we're ignoring what he actually says. But we have. So always pay attention, be careful. What does the scriptures actually say when you interpret it and try to apply it? And I think Elijah illustrates that principle to us here. So we'll see as we go on. We're not through with this little incident yet, but we'll see how this works out. Questions or comments? All right, we'll let you roll. That's Jean's card. Anybody wants to put a little note down there, please do, and we'll get it to her. Otherwise, we will see you 704. But I would call first before I did anything over there just to make sure. Her son was quite emphatic in that regard, so. Okay, we will see you all next Sunday, Lord willing, or Thursday for some of you.